The second objection, this is one that is often raised, especially in our modern day, in our modern society, is that celibacy, lifelong celibacy, is unnatural, unhealthy, and sexually repressive, and, you know, psychologically unhealthy for a man to make that kind of promise and to forego or renounce sexual experience, having a wife as a companion in life and having his own children is so detrimental to the nature of human beings that it's going to always cause problems for the priest, for someone who practices that. Okay, it's unnatural. And it's not, celibacy does not adequately address the sexual desire and need for family that every human being has. Therefore, it shouldn't be forced upon, you know, men who want to become a priest. Right? So how would we respond to that? Well, very simply, there's an element of truth to that, and I want to be clear here. It is not natural in the sense that the natural vocation or the natural relationship between men and women is for them to join together in marriage, a man and a woman, a husband and wife, to have sexual intimacy and intercourse, and in the course of that to bring about children and raise a family together. Because that's how God has made us, right? God has given us sexual desire, romantic interest, romantic desire, and that's normal and natural and good and healthy. That's why we obviously have the sacrament of marriage and why the majority of people are going to have a vocation to the married life. That is the natural course of things, the natural order of things. It's right out of the book of Genesis, right? That is why a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh, okay? So it's right to say that that is the natural order of things. But I don't think then that you can take the next step and say, therefore, someone living a celibate lifestyle is living an unnatural lifestyle that is going to cause them psychological, emotional harm. Because there's another possibility. If something is natural, it doesn't necessarily mean that, or excuse me, if something is not in accordance with the natural order of things, that doesn't necessarily mean it's unnatural. It could also be supernatural. That means above the natural, right? So a calling to celibacy is a supernatural calling, right? It's above nature, not against nature. That's two different things. So I would argue or respond to someone who says, well, it's not natural. I'd say, well, you're right. It isn't. It's supernatural. It's a supernatural calling. Now, the person may respond to saying, well, fine, you can call it whatever you want. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, men and women have strong sexual desires and you're just repressing them by not getting married, by not being sexually active, by being celibate for the sake of the kingdom. And it's not healthy. And it's not going to, you know, promote psychological or emotional, physical, sociological health in the priest. And I would argue and say, no. If we believe that, then we are devaluing the power of grace, of God's grace. Okay? Now, is celibacy or renouncing marriage, is it a sacrifice? Is it difficult? Is it a hardship? Yes, absolutely. Because just because a priest renounces those things, those beautiful things of married life and the companionship of a spouse and family and children, just because he renounces those things doesn't mean that the desires then go away, right? In other words, just because a man makes a promise of celibacy doesn't mean then that he no longer experiences sexual desire, desire for companionship, desire for children, desire for his own family, etc. Those desires are still there. But the question becomes, how does he satisfy those desires? Right? The married man satisfies them in the natural way, with his wife and intimacy, by having children, by having his own family, by spending time with them, loving them as himself. Okay. How does the priest do that? Because the desires are still there. He unites them in his ministry. He integrates them into his ministry and seeks the power of God's grace to satisfy those longings. Right? Now, what does all that mean? Well, it means that he still gives of himself, not in a sexual way, but in a pastoral way, in a loving way. So he's still making a gift of self in love, just like a husband does to his wife, but in a different mode or a different way. He gives of himself in sacrifice to his bride, the church, okay? By giving up his time, by giving up what he would like to do, by giving up and being willing to suffer for her, by being willing to be obedient to her, to be subject to her, to the church, okay? By honoring her, in sickness and in health, till death do us part, right? He does that on behalf of the church. And those times when the loneliness comes, those times when the desires for a wife and for family are strong, are opportunities for him not to repress them, because that isn't healthy, right? To just ignore them or push those feelings beneath the surface and pretend they're not there, but to calmly turn those over to God in prayer and to acknowledge them and say, yeah, you know, there is a sting to this. There is a sting to celibacy, you know, of not having those joys of family life. But there also is a peace and a grace and a joy that comes with doing something that is difficult for a greater good, sacrificing for a greater good. And just as a husband has to do that in marriage over and over and over again, and a wife too, by the way, for his wife and for his children, so the priest does that, but he does it for Christ and his church. Okay? So it's perfectly possible for someone to renounce or give up married life and love and sexual expression and still be psychologically and emotionally healthy. But it takes some work, because we would agree wholeheartedly that repression is not a good thing. Those desires need to be addressed head on, but that they are addressed with the power and grace of God and of Christ. And also in the recognition that, you know, our society, as I said before, is soaked in sexual desire and lust. It's everywhere. All I have to do is turn on the television, right? I mean, the amount of immodest behavior, immodest clothing, immodest speech, sexuality, explicit material available online, available in movies, available in music. Sex is everywhere. And we have trained ourselves to a certain extent as modern secularists, modern Americans, to believe that without sex we will die, right? That we can't possibly survive. It's like a desire that is so demanding that it can't be resisted. And that's where you get this attitude that people have of just do whatever you want, do whatever feels good, don't let anybody tell you what you can and can't do, because you can't, you know, the thought is, well, you can't control it anyway. It's instinct, you know, and to try to hold it back or restrain it or abstain is somehow unhealthy, repressive, right? And we would say, no. In fact, the healthy human being, the healthy human person is the one who has their passions, their emotions, their desires subject to and under the control of their intellect, their mind, and their will. So that my passions and desires and emotions, they don't control me. I control them, right? That's the problem in our modern society so oftentimes, is that people are controlled by and make decisions based on their emotions and their desires and their fleeting passions. And all the way back to St. Thomas of Aquinas from the 1200s, the Christian, the properly ordered human person is supposed to be aiming towards the goal of my passions and emotions and desires, as important as they may be, as strong as they may be, have to be subject to my mind and to my will. They don't control me, I control them. Right? And so I would simply argue that it's just not the case that it is de facto unhealthy to forego or renounce marriage and married family life and a marital relationship with a woman. It's not unhealthy to forego that. It could be if it's not done properly, but it's not just by itself, by its very nature, unhealthy. Okay? The last objection, and I'll keep it short, it's a short one, that is often made is that we should let our priests get married because they'll be better at ministry to married people and to families because they themselves are married and have families and they know what it's like. You know, right now you have priests who are not married. How can they possibly understand, empathize with, or help married couples, especially if they're going through difficulties or family troubles, right? I think there's an easy response to that, and that is that to say, is it really the case that you can only help someone if you've experienced the same thing they've experienced? Or is it really the case that you can empathize with and sympathize with someone without having experienced that same thing yourself? Okay? So, I mean, we do it all the time in society, right? So, for example, you know, a lot of times when somebody's really struggling, they may go to therapy sessions and go to see a counselor to help them work through their difficulties. That's great, all right? But what if we said, you know, like let's if I were to create a scenario, okay, and say, let's say I lost a dear loved one very tragically in a car accident or an airplane crash or something like that. Maybe my parents, heaven forbid, or my brothers or, you know, whatever, is to say, well, the only therapist that's going to be able to help me is one that's experienced losing their parents in a car crash. Well, no, we would never say that because, or at least we shouldn't say that because they're trained to help with grief, right? They're trained, they've seen a lot of things, they've experienced a lot of things, but we don't require of, you know, therapists that we go to, for example, or counselors to have experienced the exact same thing I've experienced in order to know what I'm going through. It's true, they're never going to be able to know exactly what I'm going through, but even if they had experienced what we think is the same thing, it's different for every person. So what I experience in suddenly losing a loved one is going to be different than even what that therapist may have experienced if they suddenly lost a loved one. It's not going to be exactly the same. And so the same thing is true for the priest, right? Is that the priest, yes, it's true, he's not married, but he grew up in a family, right? He grew up around marriage, seeing it in his parents. You know, he has siblings typically, not always, but siblings or aunts and uncles or cousins or dear friends who are married and is enough of a part of their lives that he sees what married life looks like. And, you know, do we need to have experienced exactly for ourselves in order to be able to help someone else? Well, no, we do it all the time where we help people and we haven't experienced what they've experienced, but we're there for them. We listen to them. We give them advice. And you know, sometimes it's good to have an outside opinion, an outside objective opinion, right? Because if I'm doing, for example, marriage counseling and I myself am married, there's nothing wrong with that. But my experience with my wife is probably going to influence how I help this couple, right? Whereas the priest doesn't have that experience. He just has a desire to help. So he's coming from it from you could say, a more objective stance, right? Plus, of course, then there's the theological training, the life of prayer that he should be living that helps him in being able to help other people, okay? So While I think where that critique or objection would be coming from, I don't think it holds much weight because we don't use that argument very often in other aspects of life. Okay? And it's simply just not true. So that's enough for now. I know this is a little bit longer podcast than normal, but it's good to understand these objections and understand how to answer them. On Friday, I'm going to start talking about the question of why is it that in the Catholic Church only men can be priests? Okay? Until then, take care, and we'll talk to you soon.